damn Wells Fargo wagon kid in Anno of Inferno, what was the last Ron Howard movie you paid to see?
I'm Joanna Robinson, and since I am not a fancy New York film critic, I pay to see Rush in the theaters.
Hey, it's me, Dave with the Seven, and the Da Vinci Code, damn it.
I'm Matt Patches, and I guess I'm a fancy New York film critic, but I didn't want to see The Dilemma. I didn't want to see other movies by Ron Howard in theaters. The last one I paid for was Frost Nixon, but the last one I actually got my money's worth was for The Missing.
And I'm David Ehrlich. I definitely vividly remember paying for Dante's, in, what was it called? The Da Vinci Code. What Dave said. What Dave said. Dante's Code. Whatever.
Dante is the Inferno.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. This is episode 142 for Tuesday, October 25th. And on this day, in 1978, Jamie Lee Curtis's debut in Halloween was released. That was her actual film debut?
That's what the internet says. Let's not think too hard about it.
I will not. Happy Halloween, listeners. We're back with another spooky episode. We're really in the spirit this year. I wasn't expecting it.
And P.S., we killed Katie off in the pre-credits sequence.
And Joanna has single white female or something? Is that a scary movie? I don't know.
No, that was like a Scream reference. That makes me the final girl. So,
Oh my god. This is getting scary already. And if you think it's going to get scary, just wait until we read our reviews for this week.
Two reviews.
That's just counting. That's not Halloween.
we have three reviews, actually. One is an update. First, why isn't that cool? Gives us 5 stars and says, look, .. Talk about Carol more. Thanks. That's the review.
Oh.
Listen, why isn't that cool? From your lips to God's ears, you know? Well, let's see what I can do. Good, not great, says, remember when they used to review movies? I love this podcast so much, it gets 5 stars, but without their weekly reviews of the most popular release, I've been lost. Literally lost. Where am I? I miss the weekly movie reviews so much. How am I supposed to know about the quality of films like The Handmaiden or Kevin Hart's new stand-up? Did any of us see Kevin Hart's new stand-up?
No,
special?
I don't understand seeing almost any stand-up specials in theaters. I mean, I get it as like a Fathom event, but I don't know. That's not my I guess Halle Berry
is also a Kevin Hart special. So to be fair, did you see Boo Madea Halloween?
No, but I wasn't invited to see that either.
Nobody
I've actually seen many Madea movies,
and
but this one
Hart,
I didn't have time for.
The Kevin Hart film was in the middle. It was the first, and this is how he hyped it up, was the first stand-up film that was done in a football arena, and they had like 50,000 people there, and it was crazy.
Oh wait, okay,
they have like
fuck
spy,
that. That's not a movie. I
like
apologize.
An espionage plot. Side
but we.
Why don't we do movie reviews?
We
should
try
reckon
to do
with this
more
fact.
Movie reviews soon.
I think the problem is the quality of the movies. Quite honestly, we haven't been we haven't run to our microphones to and felt a burning urge to tell you what we.
Well, last week was just 3 segments of reviews, so we've absorbed any reviews into the main show because otherwise we'd just be talking about I don't know politics.
I'm getting married, damn it! It's a full time job.
Oh well, no one wants to talk about that.
We'll understand.
We'll find back to it. And finally, we have. A familiar voice, Lawrence of Alabama, says,
aww.
Movie fan that has not a liberal lamb, 4 stars. Re-review, I posted a review last week after listening to your political rant. After hearing your on-air rebuttal, I have added a star. Sure, you bashed my lack of grammar, composing on an iPhone and doing so in an irritated mode, is my excuse. Grammar policing is the easiest way of debunking an online argument. However, You could have assumed, since I was from Alabama, I was an ignorant redneck. You could have dogged my values as an obvious Republican. You didn't. You gave me an opportunity to vent, even though it wasn't all favorable. For that, I will continue to listen. While I may still disagree with some viewpoints, you have at least appreciated the people that take the time to interact with your show. I've been listening for years, started listening to film podcasts with Film Spotting when they were called Cinecast. They were even on my cast years ago. You are now my go-to cast for interesting conversation. Just lose the polarizing political jargon and I'll chill. Well, wait. Lawrence of Alabama, I can't promise that we're going to lose the polarizing political jargon, but it is my hopest of hopes that 2 weeks and a few hours from today, we will have much less incentive to bring them up as frequently as we do now, and as we will again later in this episode, fair warning. But yes, once the election has passed, and we as a country can put a pin in this for at least a couple of years, maybe we will have segments that are a little bit less aggressive.
See, Joanna goes away for like 2 weeks and they actually start reviewing the show, and that's when we're fucked. So I'm glad that Joanna's back, because now we're just going to get... I love Joanna on the show reviews.
Speaking of online political strife, I feel you, Lawrence from Alabama, because I've had to block my father on Twitter. He asked me today if I would unblock him, and I said no, not until after the election, and he said fair enough. So we're all...
Does he tweet about the election?
We both do. So we're all dealing with election strife in our own ways on podcasts and social media, around the dinner table. We're all, I think, looking forward to this being over. So,
well, one day your dad will emerge from his Twitter egg and be a real velociraptor, and it will all be good. Why don't we actually do the show?
Sounds good to me.
Black Mirror is a show. Television show no longer seems apt. It is a show. It is
movies.
It is based on a Arcade Fire song from their album of the same name, I believe. Their best album, I would say. It's been a... Oh yeah. And it's been very loosely adapted from that song and album, in that it is now a series about technology and spooky and how all these things that we use to bring us together are actually cementing us and pulling us apart. It's a very didactic, very popular sci-fi show that operates like a Twilight Zone. You know Black Mirror. Come on.
Objective intro to Black Mirror.
The third season is now on Netflix. It has finally arrived on these shores for all to see in the United States and beyond. And we are going to discuss it. There are six episodes.
You summoned Joanna to this podcast to talk about this. Why?
I did. So there are six episodes in this season. I have, I'm afraid to say, only seen two of them. Although I hear very good things about the one that Danny, the guy who made...
Dan Trachtenberg.
Dan Trachtenberg, the guy who made...
you call him Danny because we're close personal friends.
No, it's because it's his Twitter handle, Danny TRS, who directed 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is a film I like very much, directed, I hear it's very good. I have not seen that episode yet. I have seen an episode called San, someone help me out here.
You can just say Junipero, because that's what they say.
San Junipero. I was going to say like Jacinto. It's not that I couldn't pronounce it, but could not remember. And also the first episode of the season, which is called Nosedive, which was directed by Joe Wright, of Hannah and Anna Karenina and Pride and Prejudice fame, and The Soloist.
And Pan! Don't forget Pan!
Pan. And that is the episode in particular that I wanted to talk about for two reasons. One, relative to the other episode. One, because I think it's less vulnerable to spoilers than San Junipero, and therefore might make a better discussion right now, which is so soon after the episodes have launched on Netflix. And two, because Joanna, friend of the show.
Hello!
Back now. Was saying very positive things about it on the internet. And whenever anyone says anything positive on the internet, I summon them to this chamber
to defend themselves,
defend their lives. So Joanna, speak for yourself.
So, you know, anyone who's, I think this is the episode that they've been touting the most, in advance of the season. They usually try to lead with their strongest, what they think is their strongest episode. And this episode
is with the most famous people in it. I mean, Bryce Dallas Howard seems like the most recognizable person in the whole series.
I think that's true. Yeah, especially after Jurassic World and Pete's Dragon. Kelly McDonald's in the series, though. I guess she's a little lower on the fame
for
spectrum.
All you brave heads out there, yeah.
Dave. And but so it's an episode about a dystopian / utopian future where everyone walks around with the filter in their eyeballs so you can see other people's ratings. Everyone is scored based on some sort of esoteric social media thing. It's like a combination of all social media ever and this big scoring system.
Although I think in particular, the one that resonated for me was Uber, because that is the only social media I use that has an explicitly like a system that's based on mutual ratings.
There you go. Yeah, so you can rate every single interaction. So, for example, Bryce Dallas Howard, who really wants to bump her score, is overly cheery and chipper to every barista, every rando she sees, every Uber driver, you know, in the hopes of getting her score boosted. She gives them all 5-star ratings, hoping that they'll return the favor and give her a 5-star rating to boost her average, because this world has rules based on what your star rating is. It's like a caste system. So if you're under a 3, you can't get on certain flights, you can't rent certain cars, you can't do certain things because you're an undesirable. And, you know, Bryce Dallas Howard basically has, there's a brother character who is calling her out on her obsession with this rating. And we can all objectively see from the outside that she's just on the verge of breaking out of this like chipper exterior that she's put together to try to boost her standings. And as you might expect in a Black Mirror episode, it all sort of unravels for her and her rating takes, as the title says, a nosedive. So,
well, what I found interesting about the episode as a premise is that it's, at least on the surface, it has a bit of a deceptively positive twist in a way that most Black Mirror episodes don't, which is that the effect of this app-based society is that everyone is nicer to each other. It's often, and you know, almost always, it seems, not genuine kindness. It's all motivated by increasing their scores, but it has, and I guess maybe this is sort of a staple of all dystopian fiction, but it's so aggressive here that they're all so relentlessly nice to each other because this system of mutual kindness is going to
benefit. Well, it also makes some people evil because they want to punish people for not being nice and not living up to their whatever their standards are. Your way of life is not appropriate or is not nice by their definition, so you can be thrown down the stairs by people in, you know, at any moment.
And even before it all unravels for Bryce, in I don't know, probably my third favorite scene is this airport scene. But even before that happens for her, we see her fellow like 4-stars shunning this one guy whose rating has plummeted simply because he broke up with someone who was more popular than he was. And so his rating plummeted and nobody would talk to him. And because talking to someone below 3 stars and so like is damaging to you. So it's everyone's, there's a veneer of nice, but there's also this inhumanity of like you
can't. It's like real life.
Yeah, well, whatever.
No, sounds like things that like actually do happen in high school where like you shun people, break up with your friends, and like you may as well like rank your friends in that way. It sounds like most Black Mirror scarily realistic.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, I think it's very beyond high school. I mean, I think a lot of what appealed to me about the episode and resonated with me personally in ways that are not especially flattering is that it's reflective of how we are now as adults. I mean, and just how we use social media. It's less explicit in needing, like, you know, I don't go on Twitter and I rate somebody and they rate me back and we're all satisfied. But there is this feeling of, like, you know, of somebody who you respect or admire or could lift you up gives you any attention,
get them retweets.
Their tweet, you know, get them yeah, exactly. It is the sort of economy of affection in a way. And so that resonated for me. I did think that the episode, and Bryce Dallas Howard is phenomenal in this episode. I think that she really sells it from start to finish. And Joe Wright, who I did not know directed it until it was over, creates certainly a vividly pastel dystopian world. In a way, I think the episode is as well directed as can be. I did think that the emphasis on the emotional tenor of like how all these interactions were based and where it leads. And we don't have to talk about the final scene, but like where it leaves Bryce Dallas Howard's character, and it just felt like it was honing in on an element of the episode that I didn't think was as pertinent or as honest as some of the other things that it explored.
What I do like about it, well, and first of all, and also it was written by Rashida Jones and Michael Schur. So as far as Black Mirror episodes go, it's funnier than most, I would say. And what I did like about it is how much it explores inauthentic interactions, which we've all experienced. And then right when you are at the height of all these inauthentic, does anyone actually say what they mean? Cherry Jones shows up to be the counterbalance to all this. And I just can't think of a single person who better embodies, like, doesn't give a fuck, says what they want, than Cherry Jones. I was, oh, she was so wonderful. Delighted to see her show up in this episode.
Well, actually, Dave, you were mmming in the background. I wanted to know why you were mmming.
Oh, because I think the point of Nosedive is, or at least I felt like David did while the sort of climactic scene was happening, you know, sort of like it's inevitable, and it felt like it could have gone deeper to what the entire episode was about. But then I was pleasantly surprised by the last scene that takes place somewhere we don't need to talk about, but sort of like ending on such a clear, I think, like, thesis statement. It really sort of like caps off a simple story and makes Nosedive a simple story, but a simple story done really, really well.
I feel like I enjoyed Nosedive. Again, Bryce Dallas Howard really is the hook here for me, just watching her go through these crazy scenarios and become completely unhinged and swear up a storm. That's very enjoyable. But like all the other episodes in this season, I feel this weird disconnect to it. Like, it's spinning wheels. These episodes feel too long at all times. It reminds me of when Twilight Zone had to go from half an hour to an hour. Now, I know the other Black Mirror episodes are also around the hour mark, but these feel like they're overstaying their welcome, that they don't really have a great point to land, perhaps because the worlds they're lampooning already feel like they exist to me. Like, the point it's making about social media is not very profound if you spend a lot of time on social media. You know, it's kind of slapping us in the face, but is it asking a grand question? And I'd ask about all the episodes of this season. I just felt very chilly and disconnected from these episodes in a kind of surprising way because I like the other seasons.
Do you feel scolded? Like, as an internet person, do you feel like it's like wagging its finger?
It's not so much scolding as it is just obvious. I'm like, go to the next level or find a nugget.
I
want to agree very quickly with everything I'm about to say, but I will say that San Junipero, I think the biggest, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, I think the biggest thing that could have helped that episode is actually an additional 10 to 15 minutes. I felt shortchanged by it and thought that
get to its story quickly enough, I think. Yeah.
It wanted to give you a mystery, I think.
And that's a lot of the problems with the episodes, that they're so bent on the reveal, that the reveal ends up coming in the last 15 minutes when really you want to know exactly what the crazy part about this world is, and then the fallout would be the more interesting part. I don't know.
It's possible with Nosedive, it's possible that you all are just better people than I am and less invested.
That is not possible, Joanna. In the
like shallow emotional boosts you can get from social media, because like I have taken a photo of a latte before, just like Bryce Dallas Howard, and that's like, and I'm aware when I take it that it's the worst thing I've done that day. When I put it on Instagram, like I understand that it's a bad thing to do.
Joanna, I have an entire Instagram feed dedicated to my cats. Okay, I hashtag cat words just to see what other cat accounts will like them. Listen,
how are the good cat accounts though?
Well, I'm not active enough to really rally.
Also, I thought your cat Instagram was secret.
Well, it's not secret. I just don't broadcast it until now.
I didn't know about it until it was recommended to me as something my friends followed.
Well, this is my Black Mirror episode.
Black Mirror.
Not to make the stupidest point in the whole world, but the best thing that a Black Mirror episode could do, right, is hold up a mirror to our own, like, use of technology. And, like I said, I said this on our Storm of Spoilers podcast, actually, but I definitely went and ordered webcam covers after I watched the webcam episode of Black Mirror in this season.
Wow.
And maybe that's just, I don't know. I don't do anything that a webcam can capture.
But here's the thing. Like, I'm so vain. I'm so vain. I want people to hack my webcam and watch me because
oh, God.
I can only imagine.
You're stepping in every internet thing right now.
But I do want to say I love Nosedive, but I do have problems with this. So Netflix basically co-produced this season. And so it went from this smaller British show that was 3 episodes per season with a lot of like British actors who are great, but you don't necessarily recognize, to a much more Americanized version. You know, there's a lot more Americans in this season. The budget is bigger. There are 6 episodes instead of 3. So it's all just like bigger. It's like supersize me Black Mirror with more Americans in it. And I have to say, I think I preferred it smaller and more British. And
Charles Brooker, who created the show, seems to understand that world much better, and it's more specific.
Well, he still created these episodes. Like,
no, I know, but these kind of like just are wishy-washy. They're too broad. They need to get more specific and more narrative-driven. These 6 episodes on Netflix are about ideas, where I think the previous seasons that are more focused on British lifestyle feel lived in, and those characters can truly come to life.
I was reading a story last night that China is instituting or thinking of instituting
China.
China is thinking of instituting a system where there will be digital ratings for its citizens, and that the government can use them, you know, based on the citizens' behavior on social media and in the world, to limit or their travel and their privileges, or, you know, grant them access to certain things. And I wonder if the immediacy with which the things predicted in Black Mirror episodes, and obviously that's very reflective of what happens in Nosedive, is a boon for the show, if it's a compliment to the show, or if it just makes the show that much less necessary because we are already being confronted with these things.
I would lean towards the latter, if only because of my kind of cool reaction to these episodes, that it should become more focused and not outlandish, but more speculative through character, right? If you find a very specific person in a very specific scenario, this technology can come to life in a different way. These feel like ripping headlines. And in fact, doing research on some of the episodes for Articles of Thrillist, it's all real already. They're just extrapolating it decades in the future. It just feels too real on some level.
I think you're right that my favorite Black Mirror episodes, I think of the Toby Kebbell, like, memory episode, which I think is so good.
Phenomenal.
Or the Hayley Atwell and Donald Gleason episode. Those are my two favorites before. And I agree with you that I think Nosedive really did speak to me. I would say Nosedive is far and away the standard of the season. But other than that, nothing else really moved me. And the only reason I think Nosedive moved me is just, it might even be gendered. There's just something about, because it's a lot also about female friendship. Alice Eves plays this like really perfect character that Bryce Dallas Howard looks up to and has had this toxic friendship with her whole life. It's about women trying to be perfect all the time, and this woman just being like, you know what? No, I'm done. So, spoiler, she's done.
Can I ask a question, maybe as a wrap-up on behalf of those of us who have not seen it yet, because maybe you have a child and you spend your leisure time doing dishes? I don't know.
Maybe.
Black Mirror Season 4.
The nice thing about it being kind of low-key and British before is that you could kind of hear that there was stuff like about the Prime Minister fucking a pig or whatever, but like it didn't get spoiled that much. Is there anything in this season that I need to like really go ahead and watch, or otherwise someone will ruin it for me?
I couldn't spoil San Junipero for you if I tried. So, I mean, I did say earlier in the episode that I think it's more dependent on these big reveals, but to explain them would be such a complicated process because I don't think it's particularly clean storytelling. So I would say no to the two episodes that I've seen.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say no. There's nothing that's like dun dun dun. Except, I mean, the worst episode I think is one called "Men Against Fire," which is they called their "Walking Dead" episode. And
true because it's like 50 minutes of nothing and then 10 minutes of.
Oh, whoa. Is that the one? And is that the one with the roaches?
Yes.
And yeah, I read the whole plot for that, and it sounds interesting.
But. There's a big like whoa moment in it, but it lands nowhere near my interest. I was just like, this episode is the worst. So
I read the whole plot synopsis, and it sounded really interesting on paper. But
Joanna, did you like Hate It in the Nation? That's the final episode. That's an hour and a half long.
Well,
it's a big procedural.
I did just because I like Kelly MacDonald and also Faye Marseille of Game of Thrones fan. So fame. So it's like a British crime show. It's like an episode of MI5 or something like
twist,
that.
Twist.
And drone bees. Yeah.
Drone bees.
Black Mirror season 3. It's on Netflix. There's going to be a season 4.
Yeah. Well, I think technically this was like a 12 episode season that they split over 2 6 episode seasons. Netflix.
Thanks, Netflix.
Call it one and all tonight. It's hopping at the hall tonight. Dropping at the hall tonight. Disney's Halloween treat. Creatures on the...
All right, for this mini segment, we're going to name spooky movies that we think you should see this Halloween, or maybe things that really, really scared you. Because I know Katie hates scary movies, and I'm not sure I know a movie that you've accidentally watched that has scared the bejesus out of you.
Accidentally watch or actually?
Well, both. I have to assume that you didn't purposefully watch a super scary movie that scared the hell out of you.
Well, let me tell you about this movie you might not have heard about called The Witch. I don't know, guys. Hadn't heard much chatter about it. I watched The Witch this year by myself at home on my television with my baby, which was an interesting move. Yeah. Charlie and I watched it together. And, you know, I got past the part where the baby gets kidnapped and, you know, made it through the rest of the movie. And I watched it the way that I watch many scary movies, which is with all of the lights on, looking at my cat frequently and maybe texting.
Oh my God.
But it was great. I know. It is not at all the ideal viewing experience for The Witch, but it was the only way
you
I was going
Charlie
to get through it.
And
it's really good.
The witch and the baby that she kidnaps for Halloween. You can bring, like, a pestle and mortar.
No, gross.
Like, cover your baby in gore. That's
so
horrible.
Gross.
Hey, I'm not the one.
I'm really glad I watched The Witch.
They're like 4-day old baby, all right?
No, I watched Stranger Things with a 4-day old baby. I watched The Month with a 2-month old baby. The Witch, guys, it's really good, even if you're too scared to watch it like me.
The Witch. David, what's your pick here?
Well, I'll go with two movies for the price of one because they both have very, very similar settings, and it's a setting that I think must appeal to me. They
like a
are
spooky setting based on
a, it's a spooky setting, and they are Jack Clayton's 1961 masterpiece, *The Innocents*, and Nicole Kidman. And I'm giving her authorial credit here.
Oh yeah,
her 2001 masterpiece, *The Others*.
On Hulu.
Very similar movies, both extremely brilliant. *The Others* owes a great debt to *The Innocents*, but I still think that *The Others* towers above so many of the horror movies that have been made since. And speaking about twists, as we were in our Black Mirror segment, has one of what I is the great twists in horror movies, at least in recent movies. It's not that recent anymore. But love that twist. Love that movie.
I am going to pick a miniseries, actually, that I just got on Blu-ray. It's the 1979 Salem's Lot. Stephen King novel directed by Tobe Hooper of Texas Chainsaw, Poltergeist fame. A creepy, you know, 3 hours-ish experience about vampires in a small New England town, and has one of the scariest things I've seen in a long while, which is this shot of a vampire boy hovering outside of a window and trying to lure another boy to open up so that he can bite him in the neck.
It is freaky, man. It is freaky just seeing little kids with vampire things. That gave me nightmares. So Salem's Lot is actually on Blu-ray. They just released it. What about you, Joanna?
You know what? I am going to go, before it gets ruined by Jason Momoa and the remake, I'm going to go with The Crow, which is not scary necessarily, but...
Jason Momoa?
Yeah.
I forgot it was still happening.
Yeah, it's happening. Momoa is happening as The Crow, but this Devil's Night, which is October 30th, not the 31st, you should celebrate by watching the 90s tacular The Crow. Crank up your Nine Inch Nails and put on some goth makeup and watch it. I watched it actually for the first time last year, and I enjoyed every single second of it. It's so cheesy. So, yeah, that's my recommendation before it gets ruined.
Chromoma. Chromoa?
Chromoa.
What am I going to call that movie?
Don't.
Dave, what's your pick?
I'm going to take a movie that I missed at the Stanley Film Festival last year, but luckily now is on Netflix for all of you, and I saw it, and it's hilariously great in that order. It's called Deathgasm, and it's about some heavy metal bands who figures out some music they get a hold of has the power to summon demons. But it's like a, you know, goofy Peter Jackson horror kind of film, but you should check it out. It's streamable now.
And those are our spooky recommendations for Halloween. Please tell us what you watched this Halloween after you watched it.
China.
I can't make that pun.
China. You go over to China. You take China. China, I love them. China. I have to have my China, because China.
So Saturday Night Live has a long tradition of getting in the mix of election season, and they have gone really hard this season, casting a star, Alec Baldwin, to play Donald Trump for the episodes leading up to the election. This is something that Saturday Night Live really needed to do. They've been slipping in the ratings the past few years. You hear an increasing, is this show really relevant anymore, sort of cry. They cast Alec Baldwin. Their ratings have been going
up. Are you sure
up.
You're not just talking about Donald Trump's Twitter feed?
I promise you.
Failing SNL. Sad. She canceled it years ago.
Crooked David Ehrlich can stop interrupting me.
Wrong.
So it's been doing
nasty
better.
Nasty woman.
It's been doing better and better in the ratings.
Remember that, Katie? Remember that? It was great.
The Tom Hanks episode was actually the highest rated show has been all season, which is rare. Their premieres are usually their biggest ratings. So what they're doing is working. And if you watch CNN post-debate like I do obsessively, you just hear people talking about Alec Baldwin all the time. Like, his Trump impression has gotten under the skin of not only Donald Trump, but the whole conversation in much the same way that Tina Fey's Sarah Palin did. We didn't see anything like that in the Romney-Obama race. Not since Tina Fey's Sarah Palin, what I say, has an impression had such an impact on a political race.
Who played Romney?
Wait, I was just going to say
Jason Sudeikis. And he did a good job, but Romney is sort of, Romney, like Obama, is sort of unmockable in a certain way. Like, mockable, but not in a fun, cartoonish way.
They're not George W. Bush.
Right.
Or Donald Trump, even
Hillary Clinton as played by Kate McKinnon. So, so we are here to talk about SNL, the way it is capitalizing on this election season, successfully, not successfully, what's working for us, what's not.
Even in the grand spectrum, I think, of satire in this election, is there room for SNL to play and to make a real point? I mean, it can obviously churn out debate sketches week to week, but is it making any making any impact is hard to detect,
right?
But is it making
I
a point
a fascinating and well-argued article on Vanity Fair that was by Joanna Robinson about that I thought really got to the heart of why the cold opens have been funny, but to the point of this article, the weekend update segments with Michael Che and Colin Jost, are
Matt Patch's doppelganger,
are so painful. And I think, you know, that speaks to what Matt was just talking about, which is sort of about what this show is, and its cowardice, and its hands being tied, its inability to pick sides. It needs to be an equal opportunity offender, and that really takes a lot of the bite out of its comedy. I mean, they had Donald Trump host, of course, and they've been taking flack for that for a while. Lin-Manuel Miranda did everything in his power to wipe the table clean in his monologue rap, where he all but called Donald Trump a piece of shit. But there, I do think that Weekend Update suffers from trying to level the playing field. There is something, and I'm trying to phrase this in a way that doesn't just expose my obvious liberal bias, and I don't want it to say as though making fun of Hillary Clinton is not okay. I think Kate McKinnon, while I don't necessarily know if I agree with her assessment of Hillary and like that whole thing about her being a robotic person, doesn't know how to have fun, and so on and so on, I think it's a lot less effective than the jab she takes at Hillary for being an obsessive politician and someone who's just, you know, incredibly well studied, because I think that rings more true. But I listening to them this past week in Weekend Update talk about this, like, drag out the email thing again, all the same shit. It's just that it's not funny, and that's what it boils down to me. It's like, if it's not funny, it's not funny. And when you fall that flat on your face, you have to take a step back and sort of analyze what it is you're doing wrong.
And I mean, Che and Jost gave an interview to Politico. They were on the Politico podcast, and they were talking about how, I mean, first of all, they had a lot of admiring things to say about Donald Trump, and that's, like, I guess, fine. You can like Donald Trump.
When was this?
Wait, what did they say?
I will tell you. They gave it in September, so it was in advance of the premiere, but before the Access Hollywood tapes.
Well into his
right, yeah. And they called him smart. They called him hardworking. They were like, anyone who says they're smarter than Trump, you're wrong. He's smarter than you are. He's incredibly hardworking. They said both the candidates are incredibly hardworking. And Michael Che talked about how he thought it was a mistake to alienate Trump fans as viewers, and how they wanted to have jokes for everyone. So yeah, I think that's the problem.
Che
is
hates
that
Hillary.
Che, it is so clear that Che hates Hillary. But wait,
a woman.
Yeah. But leaving partisanship out of it, which we can try to do.
We will.
I think what's been clear about the political comedians who have been really effective this season is that they take a really strong stance. So I think your Fallon and your Kimmels, because they have no desire to weigh into this, are not very effective at all. Whereas your Seth Meyers, who's like, here's my opinion, I'm going to really, really sharply define it and give it to you every week. John Oliver the same, Samantha Bee the same. And so as a liberal, because they are liberals, I respond to it. But I'd like to think that if there were a conservative comedian giving their very strong point of view, similarly, like, their audiences would respond to it.
But do we have an obligation to ourselves and to our listeners to acknowledge that comedy has a liberal bias?
Sure, of course it does.
Like, I think that, like, as being as reasonable and as objective as I can be, which is really only so far, as somebody who likes to laugh, who appreciates comedy when done well, I think that there are deeply ingrained principles of the Republican Party as it stands today that are anathema to humor.
I don't know that I can stand with you on that.
Well,
at all.
I can stand alone, but okay. I mean, show me a comedian, not like, don't show me a funny Republican. There are scores and scores of funny Republicans, I'm sure, but show me someone who is monetizing that.
Well, Dennis Miller used to be that person for a long time.
Dennis Miller is one of the least funny human beings who has ever walked the face of this earth.
Hang on. Joanna was still in the middle of an SNL point.
Dennis Miller was on SNL, so it all comes back.
And Ann Coulter was on Comedy Central recently, so
Yeah, being roasted.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Joanna, what would you like to say over the interrupting
men? What I wanted to conclude by saying is that I think Weekend Update was extremely effective in previous elections with Seth Meyers, Amy Poehler, and Tina Fey, less so Jimmy Fallon, but that's okay, as its anchors because they took a very strong political point of view. Tina Fey talking about, like, bitches get stuff done, really, with Seth and Amy, was a very, very, like, sharp political segment. And Weekend Update felt relevant, so relevant, that they did Thursday night episodes of it in previous election years because it felt like such an important part of the election conversation. The most that Che and Jost have gotten is they did an RNC special that just completely got drowned out by Colbert and B and Myers and Oliver and all of their coverage of the RNC. So, like, one problem is there's more competition for them in the fake news / real news political humor arena. But the other is just, like, these knuckleheads are just not up for any kind of really incisive commentary, I think.
But I get what you're saying about Seth Meyers and John Oliver and Samantha Bee too. Probably Samantha Bee is the most watchable to me, even though she is the most furious on the point I'm about to make, kind of goes against this. But to me, these guys aren't satirizing the election anymore. It's not comedy routines. It's straight news reporting and investigation through with comedy, laced with comedy, to make
with,
it more digestible.
Eye.
Yeah, and like Seth Meyers' bits, while, I mean, what are the name of the bits? A closer look. I'm like, I'm not necessarily looking for the closer look. I'm not looking for someone to take what they heard on all the news channels that day or what they heard in political podcasts out the wazoo and kind of translate it for the late night audiences with some jokes. I'm actually looking for, like, a step back. I've really enjoyed Colbert, and I know we've argued about him earlier this year on the podcast because he kind of threw Trump some softballs early in the campaign.
He apologized to Donald Trump on his show.
Okay, that was way early. We've already had this conversation.
We have.
But my point here is that Colbert actually satirizes and doesn't just drill into an issue like Oliver and Myers, who want to be, I think they want to be Jon Stewart in a way, but not even Jon Stewart seemed to go this far into hard news and reporting, and they're not refracting what's happening or
but
taking a step back. They're going deeper and deeper.
What does it say to you when, like in that Seth Meyers segment, for example, he does effectively condense the news of the day or a recent trend and present it back to you in the context of comedy? And when confronted with the absurdity of the truth that he has, you know, compartmentalized and boxed up for you, you laugh at it because it's funny. Like, when reality can be regurgitated in that form and be so funny, what does that say about, A, the world at large, and B, the value of doing anything more aggressive to skewer it? Because, like, I think that, like, you know, you look at the SNL cold opens these days, and really what they're doing is just repeating beat for beat what we saw at the debates.
Yes, it's like watching documentary reenactment with exaggerated motion.
Well, this goes to this goes to, well, okay, no wait, I want to know what Dave thinks because he has
the Dave groan.
yeah,
I think that the you guys are misconstruing a lot of different types of comedians, and like there's a difference between satire, which is something like Black Jeopardy, and the truth teller, which is like John Oliver. Like, those are two different comedic styles that aren't like jumping back and forth.
Yes, sure. But we're saying which one is more successful in this time where the election seems like comedy itself, like dizzying satire that would have been written about years ago and was, which is why people keep recalling satire from 50 years ago and being like, wow, it really came true. Trump is real.
Well, I mean,
but
I
you
think
mentioned Black Jeopardy, which is totally the most successful sketch that I've seen in years. I love the Black Jeopardy
was it is nauseating to me.
I wait.
That
I want
people are talking about David S. Pumpkins when SNL busted out the best sketch, certainly the most politically relevant and
it's so
insightful.
And we as city dwelling white people are incredibly well.
I want to hear more what Dave has to say.
Well, I don't think necessarily. I mean, I think that I don't feel uncomfortable talking about the success of Black Jeopardy because I think the point that it speaks to can be appreciated by both sides. It can be appreciated by the white guy wearing the Make America Great Again hat, as it can be by whatever the name of the game show host that Kenan Thompson is playing, which is really about the divisions.
Well, what I will say is that, you know, I wrote that piece up for Vanity Fair. It ended up going a lot of places that, like, stuff that I write doesn't usually go, which I always know because then I get feedback on Twitter. Like, when a piece that I write goes further than it usually goes, strangers find it, don't know me, and then want to talk to me about it on Twitter. And I had a lot of Trump supporters really angry because they felt like I was saying this, you know, they wanted to say hashtag not all Trump supporters, basically, to me.
You mean deplorable John and deplorable Jack and deplorable Amy and deplorable...
I quite like Tom Hanks's, like, Doug. I thought he was kind of charming. Like, I don't know.
Keenan also likes the huge
point. I know.
That the idea is that these people that could otherwise, you know, have these commonalities, could get along, even if in a silly sort of superficial way, as they do in the sketch,
right.
Could interact well as people, are so pulled apart by the abrasiveness of politics and, more importantly, the racism, the classism of the policies. And so I think that, like, there was something very heartwarming about the sketch and finding these shared areas and seeing these people who, just by, you know, their aesthetics, and I speak mostly about the Make America Great Again hat, less so skin color, would be pulled apart. I mean, I thought that it was, and then of course the final turn of the knife is that last beat about the blank lives matter, which just comes back around.
Lives that matter.
It's sorry,
so concise.
And underscores all of, all the points it's trying to make, but I thought it was brilliant because not of the differences that it was exposing, but the opposite.
Wait, right. Dave, groan your way back in here.
Yeah, so it's like you have your comedians that have always been, like, you know, your anti-Nixons, anti-Reagans, anti-Republican Congress, even very anti-Clinton coming up, that are doing the whole truth-teller trope. But the problem with this, I guess, election is that one of the candidates is sort of doing that, or relying on the same thing that sort of comedy relies on, which is that you take the authority of the person with the microphone over whatever your understanding of the facts are, so they could slowly massage you to what should be a punchline, not a policy. But this year it's sort of like thrown out. So I think this year satire is even more powerful. It's just more difficult because if you cross that line to where you're trying to get, like, so sharp that you're yelling at somebody for, like, having a view, then you're just the actual political conversation all of a sudden, because that's where it's been, like, lowered. So I think a lot of it's out there, but I think we're going to have to, like, loop back to Black Jeopardy and maybe, I don't know, 20 cumulative minutes of the South Park season that's thus far existed, and we'll sort of, like, see it as diamonds in the rough, where it's, like, right now, any sort of truth-telling comedy or any sort of satire is sort of, like, getting lost in the fuzz, and instead we have to deal with, like, the dad jokes and the obvious, like, softballs.
Well, that's why I want to really shout out Kate McKinnon's Hillary Clinton. I don't know that she's necessarily been as hard on Hillary as maybe she should have been. I'm probably in the tank for Hillary, so I wouldn't be able to notice it. But I think she's done what you really need to do for a president. Parody, which, God willing, we will actually have in Hillary Clinton, in that she's kind of nailing in on one of the really distinct elements of her personality that is malleable to a lot of different places. Like, the key to the Kate McKinnon and Hillary Clinton is she's, like, transparently fake, but also, like, but not conniving about it. Like, that's just how she works. Like, she's kind of uncomfortable in all situations, even when she's taking a victory lap. And I'm really just looking forward to watching that impression evolve, especially because we haven't had a good Obama ever. So it's kind of like our first chance is Will Ferrell's George W. Bush to watch one of these presidential parodies evolve. And I think Kate McKinnon's got such a good baseline for
Do you think Alec Baldwin has been successful in trying to lampoon Trump?
I just look forward to never having to see Donald Trump on television again. So, Alec Baldwin, you've done great. I don't need to see you again.
He'll be back.
I will say that a lot of people that I know who don't watch a lot of TV, who definitely don't watch Saturday Night Live, had watched, like, I went to go watch the debate with them, and they had watched that sketch a bunch of times, and as we were watching the debate, they're like, oh, it's just like Alec Baldwin. Like, that's a point of reference for people who are not as dialed into pop culture as the rest of us. That's how far it's spread. And, yeah, it's just sort of...
Well, it's Sorry, Jordan, go on.
No, I mean, like, you're right that all Alec Baldwin has to do is say literally what Donald Trump has said, and it's a sketch. But, you know, whatever his facial contortions or whatever it is he's done, he has poisoned the well of how we hear Donald Trump, which is exactly what Tina Fey did with Sarah Palin.
And it's exactly what I wanted to say, Greg Kinnear, that's not his name, the guy who hosts the late night show, help me out in my old age.
What?
Seth Meyers.
Who are you?
Seth Meyers.
Greg Kinnear.
Whatever.
Greg Kinnear did have a talk show for a while.
Greg Kinnear should have a political satire.
Anyway, hold on. This is my rousing way of bringing it all back around. That what Joanna just
took us back to the first Clinton era.
Shut your dirty little hole. It is what that's a Stephen Colbert reference to the Strangers with Candy days to really keep everything in the talk show late night chain of events. Anyway,
90s.
What Seth Meyers is doing in his segments in the listen in focus and whatever those segments are called.
A closer look
is exactly what Joanna just described Alec Baldwin's impression of Donald Trump being. And that it does seem to be, as uninteresting as it may be to point out, the most effective way of parodying events that seem to be parody in and of themselves is simply reframing them in a way that allows you to appreciate comedy and laugh at them, whereas it's like, you know, first as tragedy and then as farce. I mean, that's how I think about the difference between the debate and an SNL that covers it. It's like watching Donald Trump be at the debate, call Hillary Clinton a nasty woman, talk about ripping babies, like as if 9-month abortions are a real thing, and so on. Like, that is terrifying. And then hearing the same words come out of his mouth or a different person's mouth playing him on SNL just a few days later is farce. And it's that maybe that bit of breathing room, that context is really the only difference that we need.
Although I think...
And the fact that that Baldwin is getting under Trump's skin, so obviously we'll never...
I know. Yeah,
it's really hard. Really hard to get under
Apparently
Trump.
It's getting under Billy Baldwin's skin.
Stephen Baldwin. I want to give a shout out to two more impressions. Because I actually don't think Kate McKinnon does a good impression of Hillary Clinton. She just does an enjoyable Hillary Clinton. But she did do a very good impression of Kellyanne Conway. And now when I hear Kellyanne Conway, I can't help but think of Kate McKinnon. And a shout out to Laura Benanti's Melania Trump. Because that is like
on Colbert. Yeah.
That's, you know, Cecily Strong's Melania is fine, but like Laura Benanti's is really good. And so now when those women speak, I just hear those actresses mocking them. I'm sorry. That's my partisan. That's what I hear.
Man,
so.
Well, the Kellyanne Conway sketch on SNL is also, like, we haven't mentioned it, but it's also incredibly good. I don't know if it's even good satire. It's
really funny.
It was funny. The Melania-ade last week, which I thought was a very smart concept.
Oh, I thought that was great.
Very poorly executed.
Oh, I liked it.
Oh, I thought it was well done, but I think it mistakenly makes these women into any kind of hero when... Do you know, like, they're not victims of Trump. They are active participants.
No, and that's something that I've really been struggling with in this whole thing, where it's so clear, like, the shades between good and evil are not particularly hard for me to divine. I have been struggling a little bit with my feelings about Melania Trump, and in particular wrestling with, I don't know, just being sad at how little sympathy I have for her. And not judging myself for that necessarily, but just thinking that it's a sad state of affairs where I look at her with as much... antipathy as I do.
I don't really think of her at all. I'm sort of the Don Draper in this situation.
Wow. You're not sitting around thinking Melania Trump? Oh, terrible. Well, I just want to say one thing, which is, you know, this whole election season, getting our comedy from talking heads mostly, and these people who just yell at us. Even Seth Meyers now yells at us. He was such a nice man, a nice boy.
I love Seth Meyers.
But it's really just screaming like Trump to try and overpower his voice with truth. And it becomes very exhausting. I mean, people who listen to this show know that we kind of slam John Oliver a little bit.
I'm going to go with wrong.
No, let me finish here. I wanted two shout-outs here. Jordan Klepper on The Daily Show has been doing these man-on-the-street segments. And this is what I want to see out of the election. And it's been the most, you know, it's been poignant and hilarious. Because this election is about who could possibly
follow Trump? Who are these people who are devout followers of Bernie or Hillary? And all these people, these players, who are the constituents that are supporting them diehard and getting out there on the street and actually talking to them, listening, is actually so much funnier and so much more important than having all these talking heads who are screaming at us. And this is why we talked about Triumph, his election specials. They're all on Hulu now, and there have been a few more since we've talked about it. They're just so successful. And in Triumph's case, he's actually staging stunts and making it more of sketch comedy and satire, which I love. But even Jordan Klepper is just killing it.
The real
on the
Roger
show.
Ailes at the RNC.
The Roger
the
Ailes lookalike
of my life.
Is a shocking. It's just like people are so fame hungry and they're star fucking. A fake Roger Ailes can get Triumph, this hand puppet, to like the center stage of the RNC. It's insane. I highly
you're
recommend both those guys.
You're the puppet. just to add on to what Matt was saying, the sequence in the Triumph election special with Mr. Belding as Benjamin Franklin, I asphyxiated and died, and now this is my ghost talking to you. I was laughing so hard.
Did you see highly the follow-up where he drove a tank down?
Oh, yes, I did.
Around the Republican National Convention, that was just shocking. Just shocking. And that's what I'm missing from this election. Someone to stand outside of the system who doesn't have to scream and yell about what's right and what's wrong and try and force it down my throat with comedy. Make observations. Don't try and make points.
Okay, Because here's the problem with what you said, is you just described that racist Asian Fox News segment that took place in Chinatown. You didn't describe, you know, a controlled.
I mean, I did. I did describe that, but it's not.
Patches
might not
love
work,
that
but
segment.
It was a good experience. It was hilarious. What are you talking about?
I'm saying what you're trying to what you want is so hard that doing it irresponsibly, I'd rather it not be done. But
I want to stand up one more time for my boy Seth Meyers and say that. The one thing that we need to consider about what Seth Meyers has been doing from the start in this election is that he's doing it from the belly of the beast of NBC, which has been the source of a lot of criticism for going so soft on Trump. And Meyers never once has. He's got a fake ban on Trump on his, like, he has gone hard on Trump from the start in a way that none of the other late night hosts on a network did. And he's maintained it all the while cashing peacock checks. So,
well, just to play devil's advocate, it's easier when nobody watches your show. It's easier to do that. Stephen Colbert was not. I mean, Stephen Colbert has a much more prestigious property at CBS, and I'm sure the rules are a little bit different. And I think that it was bold of Stephen Colbert on his own time in that video he recorded from home or wherever he was last week or 2 weeks ago to tell Donald Trump to go fuck himself. I think that there was something more outrageous about hearing the host of The Tonight Show say, go fuck yourself, or The Late Show, whatever that's called.
Yeah.
To say, go fuck yourself to a presidential candidate than it is for somebody in Seth Meyers' position to go after him. I'm not trying to equivocate the two. I'm just saying that, I don't know.
I will say it was delightful.
It's hard
because
for me to stay mad at Stephen Colbert.
I know. And then that's okay that you guys are more forgiving of Colbert than I am. But like, it was delightful to have Samantha Bee, Stephen Colbert, and Seth Meyers all respond with fuck you on air to Donald Trump on the same, like, within a couple nights of each other. It was pretty effective. So that's not satire, though,
easy.
Dave.
It seems easy.
You're easy.
No,
you're
puppet.
Easy.
No,
you're
puppet.
Easy. You're the
guys,
puppet.
We're so close to surviving this election. Like, it's so close.
2 weeks.
Oh, you mean
almost done.
Just
with the podcast.
Yeah, right. It's 2 weeks for us, but it's also like an eighth of Charlie's lifetime. So
yeah, I know.
It's all relative.
I'm very worried that I will think of the first few months of his life and think of Donald Trump talking in various.
You better
cases.
Hope
just feeling sad and terrified.
That babies don't take this
in. Well, it's been a lot of reading 538 at 3 in the morning when I'm up and just being like, oh, how are things going? Which is, it's gotten
speaking
better,
of which,
know?
Wait, I did, I want to, this does relate to Saturday Night Live, I promise. I was listening to 538's Ross Perot special which went up on their feed today. And it was fascinating to me because even though I lived through that time, I did not realize all the ramifications of Ross Perot, who was actually a really, really like interesting proto-Trump. But the first thing that came to mind as I was listening was Dana Carvey's impression of Ross Perot, because it was so vital to me growing up. So there's ways in which these comedian impressions can outlast the actual politician, especially if you're of a certain age when you hear them. So...
wait, was it Ross Perot or H.W. Bush that was can I finish?
That was...
Yeah, okay.
It's
Ross Perot. It's so
George
sad,
Bush was not going to do it.
That would not be prudent.
Would be prudent
not, do it.
In this
do
juncture.
Oh, Dana Carvey. Where
he's
are
got,
you? I guess, hosting that weird impression.
No, he has a Netflix special coming.
Netflix special, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, is he doing impressions?
Probably,
or just
let's be honest.
He's about to make impressions great again. That's what I decided.
Speaking of impressions, let's wrap up this segment by doing a Donald Trump impression off. Who will win? David?
It's throwing me on the spot. I don't know. What are we talking about?
I don't know. What's your line?
Just do one.
You're the puppet. You're the puppet.
No, that's not a good. That's not really.
What's a good Trump line for you to do?
I think this 27 minute segment ended when Katie asked where Dana Carvey was.
Hell no! This is the end. Here
okay,
we go.
Okay, do
no,
it.
No, I got one. Okay, just China.
Okay,
China.
Dave.
That's the easy out.
That's gonna be hard to top. Joanna?
I guess I'm gonna go with nasty woman.
Such a nasty woman.
David, come on.
Let's see. What to say? number one, I have great respect for women. I was the one that really broke the glass ceiling on behalf of women more than anybody in the construction industry.
Oh my god.
I did like
nobody
SNL
has
sketch.
More respect for women than me.
The SNL sketch this week where the entire world laughed. My impression has to be WikiLeaks.
Yeah, that's thank good. You, that's good.
I don't know, Putin.
Oh.
I mean, he's a good leader.
<I don't>
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week, 1 week closer to Election Day. Hallelujah. Congratulations to us all. In the meantime, who are all of you people? Joanna, I guess we start with you since you don't have a spot in the routine.
Hey, listen, I write for this website, VanityFair.com. You might have heard of it. You can also hear me talking about things on Storm of Spoilers, Little Gold Men, Decoding Westworld, Fighting in the War Room, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And I am Matt Patches. I'm the senior entertainment editor of Quillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com. And you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, you can leave comments, you can try and do your best Donald Trump impression through text. I guess recreate his tweets if you wanted to. Great. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together. Even Joanna will pop by. On Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, blogging at geek.com, putting some stuff up at thrillist.com, and podcasting at fightinginthewarroom.com, where this season's Storm of Spoilers off-season tour is happening.
And I'm Katie Rich. I'm also at vanityfair.com, and I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRach. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, which is where you can answer this week's lightning round question. But first, my answer, because I wasn't around, the last Ron Howard movie I paid to see was when I drove across state lines to see A Beautiful Mind by myself when I was in high school, because that's the kind of kid I was. But yeah, everybody, what was this week's lightning round question?
What was the last Ron Howard movie that you paid to see?
Turns out that's what it was. So answer that, tell us on Twitter what it is, and we'll retweet it, and we'll be back talking to you next week.